from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, the 18th of September, 2019. So glad to have you with us this morning. We've got a good show lined up. Our first guest is going to be Sue Minter. She is the executive director of the Capstone Community Service, Community Action Agency, I should say, based in Barrie, serving central Vermont and especially focused on helping out low-income folks in a wide range of areas, everything from weatherization of homes to helping people make good employment and financial decisions, et cetera. There's just a wide range of stuff. We can talk a little bit about that with Sue, but her main reason for being here is the U.S. Census comes up next year if in fact, Congress provides some funding for it, which is still, I guess, an open question. And the one of the questions in the census is, will it do an adequate job counting, especially lower-income Americans? This is very important because you want to get an accurate count of your low-income residents in any jurisdiction because federal aid is frequently determined based on census numbers. So we'll be talking about that with Sue. The second half hour of the program, we're going to get a visit from Kit Norton. He's a real bright young reporter with VTDigger.org. He was just down in South Carolina last few days taking the pulse of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Digger's been following that campaign closely for understandable reasons, given that Sanders is from Vermont and everything. And so Kit's going to be giving us an update on what he's seeing and hearing on the ground with the Sanders campaign. That should be interesting as well. In the second hour of the program, I've had some instances lately where folks have wanted to call in. We've needed to go to a break, couldn't take the call. Someone else called the other day about our 9/11 segment with Garrett Graff, and unfortunately they were calling in the middle of a following segment about the health department and concerns about vaping. So we weren't really able to get very deeply into the conversation that this person wanted to engage in. I hope they'll call back today because I'm opening the phones between 10:15 and 11, and I just want to hear from listeners, whatever's on your mind out there. I may pick through the sort of morning news reports this morning and maybe ask a couple questions as prompts. I haven't formulated them yet, but we'll have to do that on the fly, I suppose. But I'm sure that'll be a rollicking 45 minutes as the open phone lines sections here on the Dave Graham Show frequently are. But let's start first this morning with Sue Minter, the executive director of Capstone Community Action. Sue, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Dave. Always great to be here on WDEV Live and Local.
Yeah. Hey, so you have a particular concern about the U.S. Census, and I want you to just spell it out in your own words.
Well, thanks so much. I think everybody should be thinking about the census because it is the count of our Vermont population that establishes all kinds of funding for programs ranging from children to seniors to highway spending. All depends on us having a fair and accurate count. And what I know is that everybody counts, so let's count everybody. And what's worrisome is that more and more there are what we call hard-to-count populations. Listeners may recall there was a very voracious dispute about whether or not citizenship should be a question on the census, and eventually that was shot down by the Supreme Court. But we know that many people are afraid to fill out their census, or they have no idea what the census is about and may be distrusting of the government learning any information about them. So I'm here to explain. I personally always knew about the census and the data to understand. You know, I studied sociology in college, and then, you know, I was a legislator. I knew that the amount of people in your district mattered. Across the country, we determined congressional districts based on the census count. But now, as the executive director of Capstone Community Action, an organization committed to lifting people out of poverty, I understand now that this count is so important for all of the federal funding that supports programs, not just for people in poverty, but across the spectrum. And if we aren't doing everything we can to ensure every Vermonter living here in 2020 is filling out their census, we will lose federal funding, for school lunch programs, for example. So that would be an impact on your local property tax, programs for senior services and senior centers, for transportation. These are very, very important programs, and I'm quite concerned we are not doing enough at this point to promote this important census count, and more importantly, or related, that the federal government may not be doing its job in trying to promote this important census count, something that is done only once every 10 years.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, other states actually are stepping up and really within their own borders trying to promote the idea that folks want to participate in the census. I think what we're up against here is there are a number of folks out there who have fears about participating in the census. There's several factors here. One is the generally libertarian attitude where, hey, the government wants a bunch of information from me. Go away, big brother. Don't need it. I don't want to participate. And that is an unfortunate attitude that is out there because, as you say, Sue, these are times in which the federal government is talking about cutting many human services programs in particular. And to the extent that we are going to continue getting federal aid, we want to maximize that. If other states step up and promote the census within their borders, maximize their counts, and we don't, that just exacerbates the problem, doesn't it?
It is quite concerning because we are among a small group of states that really have done nothing, at least that I'm aware of, and I've been asking a lot of questions at this point to promote. And now, you know, just this week, the state of Utah joined some over 24 other states that are actually spending money promoting the census count. It's very much a bipartisan issue. There are Republican states and Democratic states, many of whom realize that their populations are growing. Now, that's not our situation in Vermont, but more and more people are in poverty in Vermont. We just, at Capstone Community Action, we just did a community needs assessment that demonstrates that we have a growing poverty problem. And what's really concerning, Dave, is that, in fact, the growth in poverty is paralleling the so-called recovery of our economy. In the last few years, the strongest economy time of our economy, our growth of our economy, the last few years of the decade are actually when we are seeing poverty rising. So if those, and we know that those people in poverty, especially people who are homeless, people who aren't really thinking and have the energy and time and awareness of filling out a census form, are those that may have the most to lose if we are not counting them. So the folks at Community Action see it as our job. We're very much the front door for people in poverty. We serve the largest food shelf here in Washington County. We had over 3,500 visits to our food shelf last year. We get emergency heating for people, the federally funded and state funded crisis fuel program. We also raise local philanthropic dollars to help people. Last winter, 36% increase in people at our door just to keep warm in the winter months. We do Head Start, early childhood development and education for kids at risk. We do weatherization, as you said. We do economic empowerment programs, helping people start their own businesses, helping people become develop assets and buy their own home. We do all these kinds of programs for people who I think may be very hard to count. So we see it as our job and responsibility, but we really want the state of Vermont and all the partnering organizations to be joining us in making sure we count everybody. It's incredibly important.
What should the state of Vermont be doing if Vermont is to, so to speak, come to its census?
Great. Well, you know, other states are essentially doing promotion and outreach. The federal government is charged with, under the Constitution, actually doing the count. So right now, the census, and you mentioned federal funding. I was just in Washington, D.C. last week talking with staff from both Congressman Welch and Senator Sanders and Leahy, especially Leahy, who, as you know, is on the Appropriations Committee. Right now, we only have a few weeks left in the federal budget year, but the next budget year has not yet been approved. And we are back and forth and looking at, what are they going to do? Another government shutdown? Are they going to do a continuing resolution? So that whole conversation is about to heat up. But in the middle of that are funding for critical things like the census. The federal government is supposed to be hiring people to go door to door. This all begins in March of 2020. So in a few months, it will start in the middle of March as an online outreach. And then in April, in fact, April 1st is Census Day. That is the first day that people will have physical hard copies of the census to fill out. Only deputized census workers, part of the federal program, can actually fill out a form. But we can promote, the state of Vermont can be promoting, just like states across this country are already. The state of California has allocated over $100 million to promote the census. All these other states are doing the same. Vermont needs to join those states in helping to promote. So organizations like ours will have materials, will have the ability to stand with folks who might be hard to count and make sure they trust this important program.
And you mentioned that the Trump administration had been pushing to include a question about citizenship on the U.S. Census in 2020. This is a something that has been ruled against by the United States Supreme Court, but now the administration appears to be, from what I read, trying to adopt other methods via the census, basically different data collection techniques other than actually including the question on the form to arrive at the same sort of conclusions. And there's a lawsuit that's been filed in which several groups representing especially Latino Americans and Latina Americans are have filed suit against the federal Commerce Department, which is the administrator of the census, and the lawsuit is alleging that these attempts are still underway to essentially try to minimize certain population groups, including people of color and folks who are living in poverty. So this is still a very live issue out there. Folks may have taken some comfort from that U.S. Supreme Court decision, but they're still at it, I guess, is the bottom line here. In the lawsuit, it says defendants, meaning the Commerce Agents, the Commerce Department, I should say, defendants' actions should also be enjoined because they are motivated by racial animus, are discriminatory toward Latinos and non-citizens, and are the result of a partisan conspiracy intended to dilute the representation of non-citizens and Latinos. Those are the words of this from this lawsuit that's been filed. And Sue, I wonder, I mean, do you feel like that if that message were to get out there to folks, that might actually prompt some more motivation to be included in the census merely as sort of an act of defiance?
Well, I think you're right. This is very much a civil rights issue. And, I think whether or not citizenship is on the actual document, I know there's a lot of fear among particularly undocumented people, but that extends to so many other people who literally are living in fear now. And so, you know, I think we come to this really as a human rights issue because we're thinking about the funding that all of the programs that we utilize to help serve critical needs for kids, for seniors. But, you know, obviously in states, the states that are really acting more proactively than Vermont on this issue are those states with a rise in immigrants. And for those states, they realize because they are providing services and it's either going to come from the federal or the state dime. And of course, they have then even more of an interest. You know, then it also relates, of course, to how we define congressional districts, because Congress is all about the population count. Now, we in Vermont are so small that we will only have one congressional district. So we don't have that same concern as some of the other states. But we do have the concern about how are we going to feed our people. When we see, you know, when I come to my office last winter at 10 below zero, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I would see a line out the door, Dave, for people waiting for our door to open. This is in Barrie, Vermont. Those folks and their seniors and their moms with kids without hats and gloves at 10 below zero literally waiting for our doors to open so they can have food, they can have housing. We do transitional housing services and homelessness prevention, but also heat. That's what's going on. And these very programs are at risk if we aren't making sure everyone is counted, because we know everyone counts.
So, folks, if you are particularly people of lower income, you are dealing with an administration that, by all indications, doesn't really want you to be counted in the census. So you might consider filling out that census form as an act of civil disobedience, perhaps. I'm not sure. But in terms of what Vermont can do or should do, you mentioned all these other states that are going to be doing promotion, really. And maybe, I don't know, the governor holding a news conference or something like that. Is that what should happen here?
Yeah, well, I've been looking at what other states have done, and quite a few of them have established a what's called a complete count commission. So getting important influencers around the table to talk about how to reach out, how to ensure that, in fact, we are thinking about, is the federal government even doing its part, and B, what else we could be doing. My view is, in some states, I guess over two dozen have actually dedicated funding for that kind of promotion, for a campaign of outreach. You know, my view is if we had materials, we could be at every library, every senior center throughout the summer, at concerts, at farmers markets, with, you know, a campaign with people with clipboards explaining what the census is, handing it to people. Now, only the census counters can actually fill something out with someone, but you can stand and educate. And it's so important for us, especially in the communities that we serve, who are traditionally the difficult to count folks, they need to trust that this is not going to be used in any way. And we know, having done the research and evaluation, that this is a program, this information will not be utilized in any other way. It is so important, though, for us to get the funding we need to actually help keep our economy strong.
I wanted to get a caller on the line. I believe Brandon is on the show, rather. I believe Brandon is on the line. Nope, I guess Brandon gave up. Sorry about that. By the way, I do want to mention that in the latter part of today's program, I'm going to be having an open phone hour from about 10:15 to 11. So, Brandon, if you want to check us out, then should be a little less busy. if you want to call us back then. So, anyway, Sue Minter, I guess the bottom line here really is that the census is an important thing. I know a lot of people are skeptical about government in general these days. The census clearly is a phenomenon where the government really does come around and talk to you about some of the data about your own life. You know, how many people live in your house, and what income bracket do you fall into, and other information that people may consider to be private or just something they don't want to share with the government. But it is important for people to participate here. Are there opportunities? I mean, if there's one question on the census I would gather might rile people, it would be that income question. Can you fill out the census form and just say, on this one, I decline to answer, you know?
I think you can. I don't think that disqualifies you. You're asking a question that I don't know the details of, which, because we aren't there yet. And again, I will probably want to come back in March with a little bit more detail about exactly what's on that census, exactly what happens if you don't fill out every question, because we haven't even got the information going yet. But I do understand and really recognize that people have a lot of distrust of government, and of course the way that information is being utilized through social networks, it's really worrisome. And that's why we know it's going to be even more challenging this year to make sure everyone is counted. My message is simply that we need to understand the value of this census and the many ways it's being used to support our state and local economies, not just for feeding children at school lunches, but when those children don't get federal funding, it ends up up on your property tax. This is critical, critical funding for so many important ways. You know, I never quite understood the degree to which the federal government really helps uphold our own economy and certainly our state economy. We want to just make sure people start thinking about the census, start learning about it. It starts in March 2020. It has to get passed by Congress, the money. This is all up for grabs right now. And, you know, at the same time, we do see a reduction, ways in which people can be concerned about programs that might be being cut, the SNAP benefits. Hunger-Free Vermont is encouraging people to submit comments to a proposed rule that would cut those programs. Thanks so much for having me on, Dave. It's so important that we keep this issue. Remember, everyone counts, so let's count everyone.
Or if you want to steal my pun for a slogan, you can say, Vermont, come to your census. There we go. Hey, thank you so much, Sue Mitter, for coming in this morning. Important topic. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back. We have a next guest coming in. Kit Norton is a reporter for VTDigger.org, and he's been assigned to cover the presidential primaries, the campaign, and especially the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who, of course, is Vermont's own, and therefore an outfit like VT Digger, which focuses on Vermont, is gonna cover the heck out of Bernie Sanders and his presidential campaign. And Kit Norton actually was sent by VT Digger down to South Carolina, a key early primary state, and spent a few days there this past weekend, got back, I guess, late yesterday, and Kit's my guest this morning. Good morning, Kit. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Dave.
And Kit, tell me your sense of... Well, first off, South Carolina, the interesting selection of states to go to. Why South Carolina?
We really wanted to go check out that state because of his history there in 2016. You know, he's historically had challenges with the African-American vote. And in the Democratic primary in South Carolina, the electorate there is about 60% African-American. Very, you know, a majority African American vote in that primary. So it's a very important vote demographic for Sanders to try to do well with.
Sanders has had a bumpy history with African Americans. Of course, in the 2016 campaign, there was the sort of spontaneous protest at an appearance he made in Phoenix, Arizona, where some Black Lives Matter activists came on the stage, and he reacted to that rather grumpily, as I recall, if grumpily is a word, and that kind of gave people a bad flavor. He later in that campaign came out with a whole set of policy proposals and so on, designed, I think, to not just purely cynically. When I say designed, I don't mean it's just a cynical exercise, but really seemed to be giving some serious thought to issues affecting voters of color, and came out with quite a platform dealing with these issues. A lot of people gave him some credit for that, but it seems like there's almost something visceral here. What is it?
Well, right. I mean, I think what you have is in 2016, you know, he was very clearly going after, you know, his classic stump about income inequality. And from speaking with folks in South Carolina, it's the feeling that he was implying that the struggle between African Americans and white Americans is the same in this respect, which is one of the reasons why he did so poorly there last time. However, this time around, you know, talking to the campaign, talking with some political experts down there, and talking with some folks who are thinking about supporting Sanders, he's really changed tack this time around in how he's going after the African American demographic. One, his state staff down there is 72%. African American, and they're really targeting rural areas of that state with door-knocking campaigns, breakfast events. And the feeling is that while he may not win that primary state with the very popular former Vice President Joe Biden leading in the polls by a hefty margin, he will be doing much more solidly with that specific voting demographic.
That is going to be a something to watch for, certainly in South Carolina. Meanwhile, the overall campaign right now has Sanders. Most of the polls I've seen recently seem to place him in roughly third place behind Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, and perhaps in some polls is Warren leading in some of them now?
I mean, it really depends on what poll you look at. You know, some it's a dead heat between both Warren and Sanders, slightly behind Biden. In others, you know, Warren has leapfrogged. However, if you look at some of the averages, it really is Biden is leading somewhere in the 20% range, and then you have Sanders and Warren jockeying for that between 16% and 18%.
Mm-hmm. Now, also interesting development recently in the Sanders campaign is he's kind of shaken up his crew in New Hampshire. What's going on in the Granite State?
So this was a story that the New York Times and Politico reported on Sunday about Sanders making the decision to shuffle his campaign throughout New England, really. And so what he did was he moved Joe Chiazzo, who had been the state director in New Hampshire, to Massachusetts to head up that campaign there and try to go after Warren. Chiazzo is a Massachusetts native, and he has a lot of knowledge about that state and the political dynamics there. And then he moved Shannon Jackson, who is a Vermonter and a close Sanders aide, he's been a Sanders aide for a very long time. He moved him from the Northeast Regional Director position, which was overseeing all the entire New England area, to the New Hampshire State Director. Position.
And is that about New Hampshire, or was it more about Massachusetts, or what kind of shape is the Sanders campaign in New Hampshire these days?
Well, if you talk to the campaign and the vibe around the campaign, it's very positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the polls, they are either firmly in second place or in first place.
Mm-hmm.
Warren has been doing very well, and she has had a lot of energy coming from earlier this month at the New Hampshire Democratic Party convention that was held, I think, September 7th. She's had a lot of energy, and she's been rising steadily in the polls in New Hampshire and also nationally. However, Sanders is very well positioned in the state where he has done very well historically. However, with this shakeup, it seems, again, from reporting from other outlets, there was concern among some of Sanders' diehard supporters in that state on his, you know, quote, steering committee, who were concerned with some of the tactics being used by Chiazzo and the campaign this time around, which is one of the reasons why Shannon Jackson came in to take over. One, he's trusted and stupendously by the senator, and also he has a lot of experience organizing on the type of level that Sanders wants in that state.
That's interesting. You know, New Hampshire actually is an interesting place to have the first primary, because one of the things that's little noticed there is the record of New Hampshire primary voters supporting their New England neighbors. I mean, I think back to the 72 campaign when New Hampshire actually selected Edmund Muskie as their favorite for the Democratic nomination. Muskie went on in that campaign pretty much to be forgotten by the end of it. Paul Tsongas in 1992. Muskie, of course, was from Maine. This is the whole theory I've developed that it really helps to be a New Hampshire neighbor to do well in the New Hampshire primary there. Maybe it's a they consider you a fellow Red Sox fan or something. I don't know what it is, but Paul Tsongas from the Lowell, Mass, had served in Congress there. Ran for president in 1992, won the New Hampshire primary, and that was his moment in the sun. He promptly faded after that when he went to other states around the country. The New Hampshire primary, to me, then seems. I mean, people complain that it's not very representative demographically, et cetera. And there is does seem to be this home region advantage. Now, in the last New Englander to lose in New Hampshire was Howard Dean, who, of course, was beaten by a fellow New Englander, John Kerry of Massachusetts, in the New Hampshire primary. Does the Boston media market seem to work in Kerry's favor in 2004? Does that favor Boston media market, of course, extending deeply into New Hampshire? Does that favor Elizabeth Warren here?
You know, I think it's fair to say that, one, you have that dense population right along the border of southern New Hampshire and a lot of overlap both in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire. So I think it's fair to say that the power of that media market does have a heavy sway. But I wouldn't say that it will be the deciding factor in this election.
What do you think will be the deciding factor in New Hampshire?
Well, it really seems like who's going to energize the base most effectively. In New Hampshire, it tends to be a more, well, in recent years, a more liberal a primary compared to other early states like South Carolina, for instance, which is a more moderate demographic voting base. So, and what you have is you have Biden, who is the clear front runner for the more moderate base in New Hampshire, and then you have Warren and Sanders jockeying for the lead among the progressives in that state. And so it really is going to come down to who's going to be able to energize and get the most people in that progressive base to come out to the polls.
Is there a danger here that Sanders and Warren will split the progressive part of the party in New Hampshire, and Biden will basically by default kind of be the selection of New Hampshire for the nomination?
It's hard to say. If you look at some of the polls, Sanders supporters, their second, they're on average, their top second choice is actually Biden, not Warren. Now, for instance, Warren, however, their second choice candidate is Sanders. So it's not as clear cut to say that Warren supporters are going to support Sanders and Sanders supporters are going to support Warren. It seems to be a bit of a different base, even though there's a lot of overlap in their policy platforms.
That's interesting. It sounds like a case for ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting, as they used to call it, maybe in the New Hampshire primary year, because you might end up with if that were the case, you might end up with a lot of 1-2s for Sanders-Warren or Warren-Sanders over there. But I wanted to go back with you to South Carolina for just a minute, because you were down there the last few days, and one thing that happened was Bernie Sanders was planning to be there, I think, pretty much coincidentally with you, not to say that you were necessarily his main reason for going down there, but he ended up bowing out of a couple of days down there because his voice wasn't doing what it needs to do if you're on the political stump. What was going on with Sanders in his voice?
Yeah, so he had a full campaign schedule through yesterday, but then scrapped it on Saturday to just have one town hall on Sunday, and then he was going back up here to Burlington to rest his voice. They were saying, oh, it was getting a little strained. The campaign was saying, oh, this is just precautionary, and in fact, he was back campaigning just last evening in Philadelphia. So yeah, he took a few days off there to rest that voice. That maybe if for those folks who watched the debate, it was a little strained.
Yeah, he sounded pretty hoarse last Thursday night, and you know, obviously you ask a question: is Bernie, does he have a cold? Is he getting laryngitis? Is this a sign of age? I mean, is there any speculation about that? He seems to be very healthy, and also compared to certain other candidates on the stump, they're pretty sharp.
Yeah, for sure. Coming from the campaign, they're saying this was just him losing his voice. And in fact, on Sunday in a town hall in Charleston, his voice was much more improved than it was just earlier on last Thursday during the debate. So it seems that it was just that, him losing his voice after, you know, a pretty hectic campaign schedule. But yeah, he is getting older, and I think it was earlier this week or maybe late last week, Biden came out and said he would release his medical records. Warren said the same, and Sanders did as well. Sanders also released his medical history in the 2016 election.
Yeah, and of course I sympathize a little bit because These guys, all of these political candidates are going morning, noon, and night, and they are talking and talking and talking in a wide range of speeches. They're having conversations, you know, one-on-one with people, with fundraisers and with their campaign teams, and it is just nonstop use of the voice. I can sympathize. I have this two-hour day radio show here, and I hope I don't lose my voice anytime soon. WDEV is kind enough to let me do this on the air here. I've felt like there have been times actually when outside of the show, I'm a little quieter than I may have been in the past, because I think there's a natural tendency to want to rest it. And so, again, these presidential candidates, whether it's Bernie Sanders or anybody else, don't have a chance to do that very much. And so I've seen others who in the past who have at times had their voices get pretty scratchy and tired sounding. So it's entirely understandable. We are all human beings with our various body parts, including vocal cords, having their limitations. Kit, do you think that Sanders? Let's take the longer view of the campaign here, and I want to ask you: Bernie is famous for his consistency, his repeated message. You know, a lot of these debates, you go up there and people talk about, you know, Kamala Harris' attack on Joe Biden, or they talk about Julian Castro's attack on Biden, or they talk about just as kind of the latest news flash here. And Bernie Sanders essentially plods along with the same message about income inequality and so on that he's had since he was first running for various state offices back in the, you know, in the 80s, even before he was elected mayor of Burlington. Or in the 70s, I should say, because he was elected mayor of Burlington in, I think, 81. So it's hard for him to make news, really, I think, compared to some of the others. Is that fair?
He definitely has been criticized for, you know, not providing anything new this election cycle compared to what he brought in 2016. And, you know, folks have said, oh, maybe he's a little stale, same old message. However, he is starting to shake it up on the campaign trail, where instead now of continuing to go back to his true and, you know, very well-worn campaign message of, you know, Medicare for all, you know, income inequality, the rich, the 1%, et cetera. He's now opening it up and allowing folks to tell stories that maybe illustrate these policy platforms that he's discussing. So he's really making it less about himself and more about the people. And this is creating news. And so you're getting a lot of folks who are telling very personal stories while on the campaign trail, which is he able to respond to.
Yeah, I saw one. I think I saw a clip online somewhere where he was had one member of the audience, a veteran who had been 20 years in the military, since retiring from the military in 2003, has developed, I think it was Huntington's disease, very debilitating condition, a lot of medical needs, and this guy basically was saying he had something like $139,000 in outstanding medical bills, no way to pay them. And he was saying right there on the floor of the meeting, I'm just going to kill myself. And Sanders was, you know, obviously trying to counsel him against anything like that, and was telling him, let's talk after the meeting. Do you know if anything was ever resolved for that guy, or did you hear that whole exchange?
I did. I think that's the last that was told about it. There's been no update on him,
yeah.
Or what situation it is.
Yeah, someone who's Sanders' supporter told me that they had ended up forming a GoFundMe campaign for this gentleman to raise money to pay his medical bills. I haven't confirmed that. I don't know what's going on with that, but I mean that obviously would be one approach. I wish that guy the best. He clearly has a tough road. And I think, you know, Bernie Sanders was definitely expressing sympathy for his situation as well in that particular exchange. But that kind of goes to what you're talking about, where he is opening up the floor for individuals in the audience to offer their own personal stories and that sort of thing.
Yes. And also just going on about this, about healthcare, you know, from speaking with folks in South Carolina, New Hampshire, and elsewhere, you know, this election is really going to be about healthcare. This is basically the main issue. It's also the main issue that the candidates are debating. most of the other platforms, you know, they all agree on. Healthcare is the real sticking point, with Sanders and Warren supporting Medicare for All type of system. And then you have Biden, South Bend, Indiana, Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris all going for more of a hybrid with the Affordable Care Act, where you add in a public option. This is the real debate that's coming down, and for the voters as well. This is a very important issue for them.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see once the primaries start, is there strong support for the Medicare for All idea, or do Democrats really end up preferring something which is not quite that radical change? And I think that there's a lot of work to do by Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, supporters of the Medicare for All idea, to promote it and get people convinced. I think there are a lot of folks out there who are not convinced as of right now. Just a couple of minutes to go here, Kit Norton, and your sense of the what chance would you give right now of on a percentage basis, if you're willing to take this chance yourself? But Bernie Sanders has an X percent chance of winning the nomination.
Putting me on the spot. I would say it's probably 70-40.
70-40 in his favor.
Against,
okay. I suspect you may be right about that, in part because it's a tough road. He clearly has some distinct advantages if you have his ideological stripe, but if you're not, then that's the issue for him is just he is a particular flavor and doesn't appeal to everybody. And other politicians, I think of Joe Biden here. Is somebody who is maybe a less strong flavor, but has maybe broader appeal. We'll have to see. Biden has his own liabilities, though, including his performance in some of these debates and on the stump and so on. So,
this is true.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Kit Norton, we are about out of time on this segment on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to thank you so much for coming in this morning. Interesting conversation.
My pleasure, Dave.
And we will be going to a CBS News break, top of the hour, one of our Talk Media News correspondents to follow that. More of the Dave Graham Show to follow. We're going to open the phone lines and look for your calls, listeners out there. What's on your mind? What do you want to tell us here on WDEV, FM, and AM? We will be back very shortly.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back and expecting Tom Squitieri of Talk Media News to be joining us shortly on the Dave Graham Show here. We've got a lot to talk about with Tom. I'm not sure how much time he has this morning, but quite a list of topics. One of the things I think we're going to be covering is the Trump administration is set to formally revoke California's tailpipe waiver under the Clean Air Act on Wednesday. It's kind of interesting to me when Republicans, traditionally anyway, have talked a lot about states' rights and the ability of states to kind of set their own course. Now we have the Trump administration wanting to really put the its boot down on California and the tailpipe emissions. Let's hear what Tom has to say about that. I believe he's on the line now. Good morning, Tom Squitieri.
Hey, good morning. Happy Wednesday, Dave.
And to you as well. And Tom, interesting story here about the Trump administration looking to essentially cut California off at the knees in its efforts to control smog within its own borders. So what are you seeing in here?
Yeah, exactly right. And this is really presidential petulance at its finest or worst, depending on your perspective. President Trump dislikes California. It voted heavily for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Mm-hmm. That's where Nancy Pelosi's from. You know, he just doesn't like California. And so this is one way that he can get back at it. It's no beyond that. There doesn't have to be deep thinking on this. California has a waiver to have stricter regulations on tailpipe emissions and other standards for cars. You'll notice that. And they've worked out a deal with car manufacturers, so it's not like the car manufacturers have been complaining a lot about this. It's a move by President Trump just to get back to California.
Well, yeah, and I do wonder, I mean, I have heard in the past when California first set these standards, for instance, that it has, because it's the largest, you know, single state and the single state economy, et cetera, in the country by far, that there is a tendency for California's rules to affect the rest of the country.
Yes.
And so I just wonder whether that is, you know, part of the Republicans or Trump's problem with this, that he says, well, why should people in Iowa have to drive cars that meet California standards?
That would be a fair point, and they're not. You know, I don't think anyone who's advancing that argument is trying to put, to use the cliche, lipstick on a pig. This is basically to get California. California has a serious air pollution problem, as many of us know.
Yep.
And they're taking steps, and tailpipe emissions are one of the largest sources of air pollution in this country, not just California, in this country.
Yep.
So California has taken a step to address that within their state boundaries. It is indeed true that California, things that begin in California, for better or worse, you know, no right turn on red started in California, you know, was the first state to have it. Now it's across the country, and people say that that has helped cut down pollution a little bit because people don't stand there and idle. So there's reason why states are called the laboratories of democracy, and some ideas emerge from different states that are adopted by other states. In this case, the stricter tail emissions that California has, they've been there for a while. No other state has moved to replicate them or even adapt them to their own state. And that's the way it's been. And car manufacturers, again, produce cars for California standards, and they deal with it. So it's purely, you know, to pretend otherwise, I'm not suggesting you are, but to pretend that it's some reason for a fear that Nebraska or Iowa will have to adapt this is not really the reason.
And, I mean, has there been any clamor that anybody knows of from the car industry to say, hey, could you please lighten these standards on us? They're tough to meet.
No, not at all. And if you look at the car industry over the last couple of decades, it's strengths and weaknesses. For example, the car industry has realized that people want more energy-efficient cars. This is even before electric. So cars with better mileage standards were imposed on the manufacturers. Your cars have to have this X amount of miles for gas mileage. Now they're moving to electric cars. So the debate is not within, is this onerous on the car industry? They sell a lot of cars in California. It's a profit loss thing. And to make these tougher standards, they can do it. They can do a lot of things. I'm not being critical of the car or auto manufacturers. I'm saying they can adapt and in the flow of changes in society, both on a national scale. And California is a big state, as you pointed out, as one of the world's biggest economies by itself. It's worth it to them.
I remember a Vermont state official here once telling me, and this may be apocryphal, I've never confirmed it, but it's kind of funny. He said that when the Clean Air Act passed in, I think, 1972, Ford and GM called meetings of their lobbyists. Honda and Toyota called meetings of their engineers.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, so, it may be a true story or not, but I think it's typical of how people react to things. You know, okay, here's an opportunity. And just think about how foreign cars surged in sales in the United States in large part because they were more fuel efficient.
That's pretty interesting. And this business about basically, I call this government by peak. Trump gets annoyed about something and sets national policy based on, so he's annoyed politically with California. He's annoyed that some light bulbs make him look orange in his estimation.
He's annoyed now, so he's in California fundraising now. He's annoyed because he sees homeless people in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Of course, he blames those Democratic administrations in those cities for that. But he wants to form some type of entity to remove these homeless people from in front of wealthy apartments and businesses because these people pay a lot of taxes and they shouldn't be burdened with seeing that in front of their buildings.
It's a reactiveness. Yeah,
it's a reactive presidency. I've made this point before in other conversations to which those who love President Trump attack me. And I said, tell me what president, other than passing a tax bill, and you could debate the merits of that tax cut. I'm not going to get into that. But that did get through Congress, his tax cut proposal. What has he done beyond executive action and these kind of statements? he really hasn't passed much through Congress. So it is a government, as you put it, a government by peak.
And not much principle. I mean, another thing Republicans traditionally have been in favor of is private property and the rights of private property owners. And now we're building this wall along the southwestern border of the United States, and eminent domain be damned, right?
That, and also it's costing more than the original projections. It's destroying now architectural rarities and heritage. There's the court cases over that that's slowing construction of it. So, yeah, all these things. The Republican Party, of course, never was big recently, not since Theodore Roosevelt, who was a big environmentalist. They haven't really embraced that Teddy Roosevelt function. They used to be the party of no deficits, and we know where that is today in this country.
Yeah.
So it's all canard.
Corey Lewandowski is a rather sharp-tongued young man who apparently is thinking about running for the Senate from New Hampshire.
Oh, there's a committee formed. He tweeted about it during his appearance before the House committee yesterday. And and I think someone forwarded me one of his tweets from today, and it was hashtag, 2020 or something like that, to tease the fact that he may run for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate seat. Now, I think it's held by the former governor, Shaheen.
Yep.
She's up for re-election next year. He's going to run for the Senate. And, New Hampshire's a far different state than Vermont. You know that far better than I do.
Yep.
So you could make a better projection whether he has a chance or not. But, you're a journalist, and I'm a journalist. And what bothered me most about the hearing yesterday was he admitted basically lying to journalists. And I'm paraphrasing him now, and so I'll probably get called on the carpet for that. But he basically said he had no compunction lying to journalists,
Yeah.
And that's troubling, of course, as a journalist, but as a deep believer in our craft, when you lie to a journalist, you're essentially lying to the public, because you could say fake news all you want, but, people read what journalists write or broadcast, listen to what they broadcast or see what they put on television.
Yeah.
So if you're lying to a journalist, to me, you're lying to the public. And he has no compunction about doing that.
In my own reporting career, I've been lied to a few times, and I think what it does is it teaches you some skepticism. I mean, it just, after a while you sort of go, and I've been lied to by people of both political parties, and occasionally, the police in the midst of an investigation will throw out a piece of information they think is designed to throw the possible suspect off their trail, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no,
I'm using the media.
It hasn't happened.
Yep.
Hasn't happened at all. I'm just saying that he's not ashamed of it. The police, you could justify what the police do. You could make an argument for that, and most reporters, we were used, I don't mean that in a bad way, they used the media to throw the suspect off his or her game, and they were able to make an arrest later. The public would say, the police used discretion in that case and this and that. Sometimes they'll actually cooperate. They'll ask the media to cooperate, not to print some information or withhold a story. At the Pentagon, we don't get the name of someone killed in Afghanistan for 24 hours. But, most of us at the Pentagon would probably withhold that information so the next of kin could be notified in a respectful way. It's not like the media and authorities do not cooperate in occasion. This is different. He's, proud of lying.
The thing you mentioned about removing the homeless folks from doorways of nice buildings or whatever, there is something that is just again, it raises the question again in my mind, which has happened over and over again. Why are particularly evangelical Christians supporting this guy? That just seems kind of cruel and, frankly, an affront to a lot of the teachings in the New Testament.
I can't answer that question. I really can't. I've thought about it as you have as well. Some people say, well, evangelicals believe that Trump will, there's some kind of thing, about the end of the world or the death of Israel or something like that, that I never quite figure out. They believe he'll lead the world to that. And that's why they like him. I don't know. But it just doesn't, on a more superficial level, I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, as you put it, this doesn't seem to comport with teachings in the New Testament or elsewhere. I can't explain it. That's one of those things where you have to have them explain it and see if you can figure it out.
I actually asked the question in a Facebook conversation a couple of weeks ago, and a person who was responding, who is a Christian conservative Trump supporter, said one word, abortion. So maybe that's the key here. I don't know. Of course,
okay.
You know, to which I responded, even if it's a sin, how many other sins do you have to overlook to try to eradicate it or something? By the way, I saw some figures just yesterday or today indicating that the rate of abortions nationwide is way down.
Yeah, as soon as you said that, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if you don't like abortion, you would say one abortion is too many, and I understand that. Mm-hmm. If that's your position, and I'm not telling anyone what my position is.
Yeah.
I'm saying that if that's your position, one abortion is too many, and I get that. So if that's the reason why evangelicals support President Trump, okay, I can understand it from that level. If that's the issue that dominates the way you support somebody in public office above all others, okay, then that's the answer.
Let's go to your usual wheelhouse, Tom, and that is military and foreign policy. Obviously, there's a lot of tension right now with Iran. The Trump administration continues to await guidance from Saudi Arabia before moving against Iran.
Yeah. One thing I didn't put in that note that developed overnight, the Iranian government sent a message to the United States, a diplomatic message through Switzerland, which is the channel that both sides use, saying they were not responsible for the attack and the oil wells, and that if the United States retaliates, Iran will retaliate back. Putting aside the words in that message, I thought it was interesting that they did send a message to the United States, which indicates there is some conversation going between the two countries, despite the rhetoric and the bombast. For listeners who don't understand why Switzerland was involved, the United States and Iran do not have diplomatic relations, so Switzerland serves as the United States embassy, so to speak, for diplomatic affairs with Iran and other countries like Venezuela and Cuba. There's a few countries where the United States doesn't have diplomatic relations, and the Swiss become the de facto embassy on behalf of the United States.
Yeah. It sort of reminds me of middle school when you want to send a certain message to a girl you like, but you're too shy, so you find an intermediary.
Yeah, but I think you were seeking different kind of relations there.
Okay. Tom Squitieri, thank you so much.
Smooching relations as opposed to hostile relations.
There you go. There you go. Hey, Tom, thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do so
again
soon.
Have a good day.
All righty. And opening up the phone lines now for the balance of the Dave Graham Show here on this Wednesday morning. And we've had a few instances in the last few days of folks who are calling in, unable to get them on the air right away. Occasionally somebody gives up, as happened earlier today. We had somebody call in during a second segment of the program about the first segment of the program, or the earlier segment, I should say. And it's just hard to break into the new conversation with part of the old conversation, so we couldn't get very far with that person. Square up the balance sheets here, folks. And so if you are among those listeners here who have tried to call in recently, here's a good opportunity. We have close to 40 minutes here on the Dave Graham Show in coming right up, and open phone lines. So don't have a guest in the studio. I wanted to present this opportunity to you to call in with anything that's been nagging at you or bugging you about something I've said in recent days, or if you want to call me up and tell me, boy, Dave, that was brilliant. That's always welcome also. And or if you just have something that you think is worth announcing, getting some word out there about an upcoming event you're involved with, or anything you like. This is a wide open public affairs radio talk show here on WDEV. I think it's an excellent service the station offers to you. I'm proud and honored to be the purveyor here, or whatever you call it, and the host, I guess, is the proper word. And join our conversation here at WDEV, 244-1777 and 1-877-291-8255. By the way, while I am in the midst of promoting our services here at WDEV, I want to mention our podcast. If you missed part of the Dave Graham Show, maybe there was a particular guest who was talking about a topic you were interested in, but you just couldn't get there because you were busy at work or you had a dentist appointment or something, you can always go to wdevradio.com. That's the website for the station, and follow the link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. And you can scroll down a bit and come up with a list of our recent programs, usually mentioning the guests and the topics, so you'll know what is tops on your list to listen to. And it's a, I think it's actually a service that is more popular than even I might have expected. I've had people come up to me and say, you know, I can't listen in the morning, but while I'm cooking dinner in the evening, I tune on the podcast. So there you go. And want to thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store. Here we're coming into a time of year when driving down Route 100 to Warren Village is particularly spectacular with the foliage coming on and all. And so go visit the Warren Store. They've got great old-style deli kind of stuff and a wide range of Vermont beers on the ground floor. They've got a terrific housewares and clothing section on the upper floor of the Warren Store. It took me a while to discover that. I don't know why. My first few trips down there over the years, I didn't get upstairs, but I have gotten upstairs in the last year or two when I've been down there. And boy, it's a very interesting and friendly, funky, and understandably almost world-famous environment for shopping there in the upstairs of the Warren Store. So check all that out, folks. Hey, want to, as I mentioned, welcome your calls for the next 40 minutes or so here on the Dave Graham Show. And there is lots going on. Tom Squitieri from Talk Media News was my guest just in the last little section of the show here. And he had some really interesting perspective on things. This issue with California emission standards, which have, of course, led the nation in trying to address the problem of air pollution for decades now, and have actually very effectively led the nation because California is such a big car market that the car industry tends to take its cues from California and has actually made great strides in reducing emissions from vehicles that are driven not just in California but in other parts of the country and the world as well. And now along comes the Trump administration saying that they want to basically tell California you can't set emission standards anymore that are any different or lower than the federal standards. And Tom Squitieri seemed to be indicating to us that he thinks it's all about spite. It's not a matter of policy. It's not a question of the car industry lobbying the federal government to say, please lighten up on these regulations. It's really just the president not liking California in general. So since they are this national leader on emission standards, let's get them, boys and girls. And Tom Squitieri sends me an email when he's going to be on the show to sort of give some topics to talk about. And the headline on this topic was presidential petulance. And I think he used that phrase on the air as well. Is this a matter of presidential petulance, folks, or are there good reasons to try to relax California's emission standards? Or is that a really bad idea? I mean, in the age when a lot of folks are becoming more and more convinced that climate change is a real problem, obviously the president is not among them. He has labeled climate change a hoax. And I guess blamed the hoax on the Chinese, at least at one point in his brief political career to date. And so there is something to mull over and perhaps call us up here at WDEV and share your thoughts. Is this effort for the Trump administration to relax the California emission standards, is that a matter of presidential petulance, as Tom Squitieri puts it, or is that a matter of legitimate policy? Maybe there is some legitimate policy reason for that action by the government. Here's the way Tom describes the change. He says the move is a major strike in the ongoing battle between the Trump administration and California over the state's right to enact more stringent air pollution standards due to its poor air quality. You remember that back in the 70s and 80s, Los Angeles was famous for smog. They had particular weather patterns out there and also heavy, heavy use of automobiles. Not much public transportation in the Los Angeles area then, and they were basically choking on smog out there, and that's what got California, I think, really interested early on in the whole effort to clean up our atmosphere here and cut back on air pollution in the United States of America. Obviously, again, these issues are not California's alone. I find when I travel to New York City, I get back to Vermont and I go, oh, yay, I can breathe again. Maybe I'm overly sensitive to air pollution or whatever, but I don't like the city air. It's maybe one of the reasons I live out here where the air is fresh and clean and lovely here in good old Vermont. But that is a that is something which people can differ. I mean, a lot of President Trump has his supporters out there. We welcome all views on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. And we invite you, if you want to call up and defend the president's decision to go after the California air emission standards, please do. Don't be shy. I think I have expressed some opinions critical of the president over time, but it doesn't mean I don't want to hear yours that may differ from mine. That's the whole idea of a public affairs wide open talk radio show here on WDEV FM and AM. Hey, we are coming up to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, and I do believe that we'll be having some words from our sponsors as well, and then back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tone Code, fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back to our open phone line session here on the Dave Graham Show on this Wednesday morning. And sure enough, we got a couple of callers coming in during the break. And I think first up was Michael from Barrytown. Good morning, Michael.
Oh, good morning, Dave. I am mindful of what the psychiatrists have been saying for some time about this guy in the White House. About 3 months ago, a psychiatrist affiliated with Harvard said, and these are his words, that he has a severe mental illness. And a book was written by a number of them from Harvard and Yale and in notable places across the country, indicating that he had a mental illness and also indicating that it was going to get progressively worse. And they indicated the types of ways that it would happen. And almost daily we have evidence of what they're saying coming true. You know, this thing with Dorian, for instance, where he took a Sharpie and included Alabama on the route for the hurricane, when it would have been so easy for anyone to just say, you know, I made a mistake there, I misread or misinterpreted or whatever. But instead, it looks psychotic when you think about the frame that the psychiatrist put it in. So I think that normally I would have great compassion for someone that had a mental illness. I am a compassionate guy. Mm-hmm. But in this case, he is just so despicably mean in all kinds of ways. Children at the border in cages. I mean, the list goes on and on. So it's very, very difficult to have compassion for this guy, but I think at the root of this, the mental illness that we're told about by the professionals is just in living color. What do you think?
Well, I have a question for you, which is, do you think that the meanness is part of the mental illness?
You know, I do not pretend to be a psychiatrist or know much about that stuff, and I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I think that you can't be normal in the head to display the types of meanness that he has shown.
Yeah.
You know, he mimicked a journalist that was limping. He talked about John McCain in disparaging terms,
yeah,
which is amazing because he was too much of a coward to go and
fight in Vietnam,
serve the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael, I think you raised some really interesting and important questions here. I think I'm going to get in a few minutes to Corey Lewandowski, who unfortunately I think is actually an example of this meanness spreading throughout our politics, especially the conservative end of it, frankly. I don't know why conservatives are more often just really, really nasty in their tone and in their attacks than liberals tend to be. I mean, maybe folks will accuse me of bias in saying that, but I do think that the tone and the civility coming from a lot of liberals especially elected officials. Now, yeah, there are some people online who are pretty nasty on the left, and there are some people who show up for demonstrations and, you know, break windows and stuff. But you know, among our elected and would be elected officials, it just seems like a lot of the real nasty stuff tends to come from the right. And Corey Lewandowski, who is apparently a Senate candidate in New Hampshire now, is somebody I want to point out a couple of things he said yesterday in some testimony before the House Judiciary Committee as just being. And again, I've said about the president in the past, I am oftentimes less worried about his ideology. You know, if somebody wants to be opposed to abortion, they have a right to get up and make that speech and do so in a civil manner. If somebody wants to think that we need tax cuts, they have a right to get up and make that argument and do so in a civil manner. But the style of this president and the behaviors, I think, are what are even frankly more disturbing than any ideological position he takes. I think what you're pointing out too, Michael.
Well, and I couldn't agree more with you. And I go back to George W. Bush. One of the things that he tried selling himself to all of us on was the idea of compassionate conservatism.
Yeah.
And I said to various people at the time, if you want to look up the word oxymoron, you're going to find compassionate conservatism.
Okay.
I have looked at the definitions of conservatism. Yeah. I've tried studying the ideology.
Uh-huh.
I cannot find anything compassionate about it.
Well, Michael, here's the thing.
If there's something, I wish someone would put me onto it.
Yeah, I actually think that sometimes these things are more of a goal than they are an actuality. And so, and I think the idea of conservatives trying to be compassionate, I want to promote that. You know, I want to say.
I would love to have
that. Yeah. So again, I'm not saying that much of that exists right now, compassionate conservatism, certainly in American politics. But if conservatives were really making a sincere effort to be compassionate and maybe let some kids out of cages and maybe let states actually regulate their environmental issues on their own because they have more air pollution than other parts of the country, a la California. You know, these are all different levels of compassion out there that this administration seems incapable of. But yeah, bring it on. As George W. Bush used to say, bring it on. It was one of his favorite phrases, and compassionate conservatism was another. So let's keep trying, folks. That's a good idea. Michael, thank you for the call.
And I agree totally with that, but yep. I'd like to see an example of it.
Yes, that's what I mean. Sure. Let's do it. Come on, quit talking and let's do it.
Well, there you go.
All right. Thanks, Michael. I got to go let's see. I think next up was Bruce in Essex. Good morning, Bruce.
Hey, good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I'm not going to mention anything about Trump, but
okay.
I want to get to the open meeting law, right to know public records, which you talked about yesterday.
Sure, yeah.
But I do have to say about this hearing where Lewandowski was there yesterday, the thing that amazed me is the conduct of the senior Republican, this guy Collins from Georgia.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing is like a frat party and laughing, going. I mean, there's no honoring an institution or anything. I mean, I'm not naive about politics, but come on.
Yeah.
And if this is the precedence for the future, we're doomed, man. Now, on to Vermont.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I couldn't call in yesterday. I was listening to your show about access to public records, public's right to know, open meetings and things like this. And,
yep.
You know, I think Ann's right. People just don't want to disclose unless they have to. I served on a select board here in Essex.
Mm-hmm.
I once had a threat to sue the select board because the chair wouldn't show me the town manager's contract when we're in executive session, and she brought it up without announcing it, a renewal.
Hmm.
And I had a threat to sue, and the town manager then, it was a different town manager, pulled it out. But, you know, the chair is also a member of the legislature.
Wow.
And she still sits in it. And this is where I call lawmakers as lawbreakers.
Yeah.
And if our lawmakers have this same kind of conduct, then again, the law is just being absolutely, totally flaunted. And it continues to go on in my town. We're talking about a merger coming up, and there was there's been no vote on a plan for a merger, you know, but they had a staff select board trustees retreat, and there was a T-shirt posted or passed around for everybody to wear saying better together, and two wedding rings joined and a date. And so I got up in a select board meeting and asked who did it, who authorized it, who paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the select board chair belittled me. Oh, Bruce, it was just fun. It's bonding. So I had a file. I had prepared it, a request for public information, and I eventually got it out of the town staff.
Yeah.
But this kind of stuff eats away. It's as if governance in Vermont is sort of a private club in some of these towns and perhaps in elements of the legislature. And, we should stop pretending that we're all so wonderful. We know each other so well. This Bill Schubart had a piece in VT Digger about an ethics commission with teeth. We really do need fundamental changes in the laws. I've got ideas for executive sessions in municipal bodies. They should all be taped. There should be a staff member there who tapes it, everybody signs an affidavit, swears an affidavit that they stuck to what they said they were going to do. Now, VLCT wouldn't, Vermont League of Cities and Towns, they would never advocate for that because they're advocating for these municipal bodies that want to hide information.
Yeah, yeah. Bruce, I'm sorry. I was looking at a sign for our next caller here. Bruce, I concur with you. I think that this is a real problem. I'm not sure. It almost seems like there's a tick or a piece of human nature or something here that when people get elected to public office, they do often think of themselves as in an elite class, which doesn't really have to answer to the hoi polloi out there. And this applies both to Democrats and Republicans. I've seen in action on this kind of stuff
absolutely
before, and it is really it's an unfortunate thing, and it's something that needs to be resisted at every turn. And I'm just so glad VT Digger and others are doing this too. But the fact that VT Digger has become such a presence on the Vermont scene in the last 10 years and is constantly filing public records requests.
Well,
I mean, it's more than, it's multiple requests a week at different agencies and town and state governments. It's a very important function because I think we, frankly, at this point, kind of need to beat it into people.
Well, and I want to give a shout out too for a colleague of yours and acquaintance of mine who's semi-retired, I think, Mike Donahue.
Yep.
And he would come in. He covered the Essex Select Board for maybe a year or so.
Yeah.
And I remember the town manager would sweat when he walked in.
Yeah, I think Donahue was a real strong user of the public records law as well, and I always had a great deal of respect for him about that. And the Free Press won some important battles in which he was sort of the guy on the lead horse or whatever. So this is very important stuff. I appreciate the call, Bruce.
Yep.
Thanks a
Thank
lot.
Thank you. Bye.
All righty. Let's go to Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
I think this next presidential election is going to measure the soul and morality of the country.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What do you think?
I kind of hope so. And I hope that the country recognizes that nastiness for the sake of nastiness is not something people want to vote for.
Okay, so if the president wins the election, that means the soul and the morality in the country has gone down the drain, right?
I don't put it that simply, Fred. I don't.
I mean, it's a binomial question. It's either yes or no.
No, I don't think it is, actually. Here's the way I would answer that question. I think that the degree of nastiness is one issue out there. I think there are also issues of fiscal responsibility. I think there are issues, frankly, of stability and of maintaining one's some consistency to messaging, particularly as it pertains to foreign policy, so that other countries kind of understand where we're coming from and have a long-term sense of that. You know, the president's saying in June that he would have talks with Iran with no preconditions, and then just this week accusing the news media who were quoting his statement as reporting fake news, as in now we don't want to have talks with Iran with no preconditions. That kind of stuff scares the bejeebus out of our allies.
Yeah, so if the president wins the election, does that mean the people that voted for him are immoral? Why would they vote for an immoral person? They must be immoral. They must be.
You know what I say to my friends who are Trump supporters, Fred? I say it's really up to you. You know, if you think that racism is bad, don't vote for a racist. If you think locking kids in cages is bad, another reason not to vote for Donald Trump. If you think that this horrible inconsistency on foreign policy is bad, I'm not about accusing people who maybe voted for Trump in 2016 of being racist or being immoral themselves. I'm saying they have a choice now in 2020 about whether they want to vote for this kind of conduct. And
so it's, the choice is going to be racism or locking kids up in cages or being that. That's going to be the choice.
That's going to be the choice, Fred.
Okay, so then if you vote for president, you're choosing for that to be your immoral.
If you vote for Trump for president, I think you really have to ask yourself some questions about how much immorality you're willing to tolerate, at least. Yeah. How much immorality? I mean, and I had this conversation with a conservative Christian a couple of weeks ago where I said, how is it that evangelicals can support this person who is doing and saying so many things that are contrary to the Gospels, right? And he said one word, abortion. And okay, so then the question comes down to, I mean, this is a balancing act, let's face it. How many sins can you tolerate in the name of trying to get rid of abortion? And by the way, you also have to calculate what are the actual chances that you're going to eradicate abortion from the entire United States of America. That's another question to ask yourself in terms of strategy or whatever. How many sins? How many insults to minority groups? How much of this locking kids in cages are you going to put up with, et cetera? So these are important questions, Fred. I got to go on. We're going to take actually one more call before the break because John's been waiting for a bit. John from Colchester. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Dave. Thanks for this open phone segment. I think from time to time it's nice to open it up like you are today.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest maybe for a future guest, I know you've had him on before, but it's probably been a while, would be Bishop Coyne.
Yep.
And if you get him on as a guest, there are two areas that maybe you could explore, and one is in regards to reporting sexual abuse cases. How does the church reconcile that with the... With confession, where a priest is held bound to secrecy and not revealing what is said in confession? So that seems to me a kind of a dichotomy there that needs to be, I'd like to know what the explanation for that is.
Okay.
All right, and the second piece is in terms of finances. You may have seen where the Diocese of Rochester filed bankruptcy.
Yep.
And I think Bishop Coyne is on record as saying that the diocese in Vermont is in a good financial situation. I believe, and this is something that could be explored, I think all of the parishes in Vermont are set up as separate trusts. So if somebody tried to sue the diocese, I think all of the parishes have been isolated from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure exactly situation is there, but that could be explored. And the other one is in terms of the amount of money that the diocese gets from the Sunday collections. It's my understanding in Chittenden County that about almost a third of the money that's collected in the collections goes directly to the diocese, which includes like a 9% tax to Rice High School.
Well, that's some interesting points and questions you raise here, and I think maybe a visit with the bishop would be timely sometime upcoming. I'm going to look into that. And
okay, very good. Thanks
for the call, John. I did want to mention Corey Lewandowski yesterday in the context of kind of a tradition of nastiness in politics, and it's not a good tradition. One of the real fans of nastiness in the history of political philosophy, Friedrich Nietzsche, the late 19th century German philosopher, who is widely considered to be sort of a precursor in some respects anyway to Nazism and fascism, And Nietzsche had this idea that you want to be nasty. You want to just be nasty to express your power and your dominance over other people. And this is carried forward right into the 20th century. And now in the early 21st century, we have some conservative Republicans, frankly, who are trying to pursue this same idea. Corey Lewandowski yesterday was testifying in front of the House Judiciary Committee and kind of went out of his way to be nasty, frankly. And this is something to consider as he is running for the Senate in New Hampshire now. I would love to see an American politics in which people are starting to say, we don't want this kind of nastiness. We don't want people just to be mean for the sake of being mean. And this guy clearly shows these kinds of tendencies. And he also said something yesterday which was truly striking. He talked about how he has no shame about lying to the media. Now, you can say all you want about the American media. It has its problems. These are all human institutions, newspapers, broadcasters, websites, etc. All human institutions, they have their flaws, as human institutions do. And they deserve criticism from time to time. In their defense, I'll say they are probably the most self-critical industry. I mean, when the chemical industry comes out with a product that makes people sick, you don't notice it putting out the word, whereas the media have immediate response when there is some mistake made by one of the leading practitioners or companies in that field. Corey Lewandowski basically said he has no compunction about lying to the media. I think that is a disqualifying statement to make at the beginning of a U.S. Senate campaign, because the media, the job, mainly the news media, are there to represent the public. So if you have no compunction about lying to the media, you have no compunction about lying to the public, folks, and that is a bad scene. Sorry to leave it on such a negative note there, but that's about it for the Dave Graham Show today here on this Wednesday. Appreciate you all listening in. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of the Dave Graham Show, and stay tuned now for Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a good one, folks.